And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
How about now?
Perfect.
There we go. Okay, cool. So how are you?
I'm good. I appreciate you setting this up. Normally, we do our thing every 6 weeks or so, which is fine. But this corrections situation is extremely of the moment. Prescient, do you mind saying? And an offer has been made today, which is good. But the offer is not particularly generous. And the issues really haven't gotten out to the public. So your podcast... This platform allows people to sort of understand the issues in a way that I hope is a little more balanced and equitable. The press has simply ignored, for the most part, the issues that these officers are facing. So since they started this job action, I've spent a lot of time. There are three facilities within... basically within the Senate District, Shawangum and Ulster down in southern Ulster County, Fishkill in southern Dutchess, and then there's Coxsackie and Green, which are up in Green County. So what brought this strike about is the first question that everybody wants to know. There was a death at Marcy Correctional Facility. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
Okay, so an inmate, while handcuffed and, like, tied to a gurney, was beaten severely and died of his injuries. And it's all on body cam. The six or seven officers who committed this assault have all been charged with crimes. Their indictment occurred around the same time as this strike. So there are those who are saying these guys are going on strike to divert attention away from these officers who committed these crimes.
Right.
It's very similar to that crazy officer Chauvin who murdered George Floyd. 99% of officers who view Chauvin and his actions in Minneapolis felt that he was a criminal. 99% of the corrections officers in New York State looked at the video from this assault on this inmate and felt that these guys deserve to go to jail. So okay. That is a separate issue. And yes, the job action has, you know, occurred around the same time. But this job action has been sort of brewing for a while. And it stems from two things. Since George Floyd's death, since Black Lives Matter, recruiting in law enforcement and in corrections, consequently, has been extremely challenging. People don't want to become officers. They don't want to become police officers. They don't want to go into corrections. And couple that with older staffers. A lot of my friends who had enough time on the job retiring. You have people leaving the job and you're not filling those slots. So there's been a tremendous pressure on officers to work extreme overtime. They're working 24-hour shifts in some of these facilities on a regular basis, going home for 8 hours, coming back and doing 16. And I mean, this seems impossible to me. I worked in a setting where I worked 12-hour shifts, and I could get mandated for an additional four. So I could work 16 hours straight, be off for 8 hours, and come back and do another 12. However, in the job that I had, we could what they call coop, where you could essentially, for a certain period of time, go and take a nap. And
right.
Everybody did that. Okay. It was a common practice.
Sure.
Your body can only handle so much fatigue. These guys have these body cameras attached, just like the police officers do. If the body camera doesn't detect motion for more than 20 minutes, it sends an alert. And then they want to know what the guy is doing so they can be penalized. So if you fall asleep on a 24-hour shift, you're getting penalized. So because the manpower is so low, these guys are working extreme shifts. Couple that with the HALT Act. The HALT Act was the corrections. The best way I can describe it is it's the corrections officer's version or the correctional facility's version of bail reform on the street. Okay. We have created a situation with the Democratic supermajority, whether you like it or not, through Andrew Cuomo, through Kathy Hochul, and through a state that's run completely by the Democratic Party, where there is no consequence for bad behavior. The more people recognize that they're not being penalized for behaving badly, the more badly they behave, which is why the MTA is losing some $700 million a year right now for fare beats. I mean, that's an amazing amount of money when you think about it. But when normal people are paying their fare and they see other people who look just like them not paying their fare,
right?
Those normal people start not paying their fare either. So then everybody's behaving badly. And what they did in the last few years is they passed the HALT Act, which I want to actually define for you. So let me pull it up. HALT, Solitary Confinement Act. And I don't even know what HALT actually means. I need to figure that out.
It means stop.
Wow, thank you.
You're welcome. I'm here to help.
I want the actual language of what the heck it is, which I can't seem to pull up. Essentially, it limits the amount of consequence that corrections facilities can put inmates under. Okay, so if you get in a fight in the jail, you will be put into solitary confinement. HALT prevents solitary from being used as a tool. So you have bad actors who are now facing no consequence for their bad behavior. And when you do that in a correctional facility, you create really bad situations. So this act only recently got passed, and it has resulted in a huge jump in assaults on inmates, so inmate-on-inmate assaults, as well as inmate-on-correctional staffing assaults. Like, we're talking like 60 to 70% increase over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And by not having the tools in the toolbox to put really dangerous offenders in solitary confinement, you're creating a powder keg situation within the facility. So that is the primary reason that these officers went on strike. They're working exceptional overtime. They are understaffed. And the tools that have been used for decades to promote compliance among the inmates has been removed. It's like the bail reform stuff. When you take tools away from police officers they cannot effectively perform their jobs. Now, on the street, that's one thing. But when you're talking about an institutionalized population, and they're not in there because, you know, they like stole my homework. They're there because they've done pretty bad stuff. That creates a very dangerous situation. And that is the primary reason that this strike is occurring.
Can I steal man the other side of that hall thing for a second?
Sure.
Okay. So the overwhelming majority, I think it's in the 80s, of people who are in state New York State prisons aren't guilty. They're awaiting trial. So
No. We're talking, so let's just define, when they're in prison, they have been found guilty after trial, or they have pled guilty to a crime for which they are in jail for in excess of 1 year. So it's not like the county jail.
Okay.
You need to define that. These are people who are incarcerated individuals.
Right. Okay. So they're incarcerated individuals who are in a situation and receive a sentence receive a punishment without a process. And I have, I've been there. I didn't do solitary, but I was in prison during COVID and wasn't something. I had an entire block back to myself, and the assistant director of Westchester Correctional came and visited me personally from 100 yards away. So I did essentially 2 weeks. It's not that as a punishment is as strict a punishment as you could get, to deliver as strict a punishment as you, other than the death penalty, to deliver as strict a punishment as you can give without a process to determine whether that person, you and I get in a fight, we both go to solitary. One of us probably doesn't belong there. I understand the need to punish, but I also don't, I disagree with the idea of punishment without a process to determine.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
You were in a facility.
County, yeah.
And you did not want to do anything bad that would put you in a worse position than being inside that facility.
Correct.
Accurate?
Yes, that is accurate.
Okay. And if by some chance you got into an altercation with another inmate and you both wound up in the box or whatever you want to call it, the solitary confinement, that would kind of suck if you were the victim of that particular assault, correct?
Yes, correct. Okay.
But the other guy would have clearly deserved to be there.
I don't know. Solitary is hard. I don't know if you and I get in a fight on the street, neither one of us is going to solitary. So I don't know why you would go to solitary if we got in a fight in a prison.
I mean, I don't know what the criteria are for putting somebody in solitary, but I do know that we've taken away the tool, and it's a pretty strong deterrent. Would you agree?
It's especially after you've done it. Yeah. It is a huge deterrent, but without a process to determine whether you deserve that. Now, I'm about to come to your side of the fence on this whole thing. It's such a strong deterrent that first off, we don't know that there are criteria for it. But if there are criteria for it, to deliver it without some sort of judicial process, to me is extreme. It's torture.
So I would agree and take the position that, first of all, everything's on film at this point. Okay, the facilities have camera coverage almost everywhere you're in a facility.
Right.
So I think that the process should be vetted. Okay. It can't be one officer having, you know, a beef with one particular inmate, and then they have unlimited discretion to do such a thing. I think you need supervisory review for a person. Okay, if there, let's just use the argument. If there's an initial altercation, and we have the video to show, but on the scene, you've got an altercation between two inmates. Corrections officers run in and they separate them and they throw them both in solitary. Within several hours, that video should be reviewed. Statements should be gotten from people who were observers. And it should be determined who the real bad actor was. If they were both bad actors, because they're both gang affiliated or what have you, okay, that's a different story. But if you clearly have a situation where there's one who was the offender and one who was not, there should be a review process to make sure that the person who was victimized is not further victimized.
Right. We agree. Now, in the event that you strike an officer, though, I come out different on that.
I would agree. I think that too is that's a changed criteria.
Okay? Exactly.
So they've essentially taken that tool away. You can put someone in solitary confinement for, I believe, 7 days, two times in a certain period of time, like either months or a year. And that is causing a problem with, again, if I'm not being penalized for my bad behavior, then I'm just going to continue to do bad things. Now, the politicians will say, well, we can take away their commissary privileges. We can take away their tablet, because they all get tablets and they can all call their family anytime, day or night. But the way it works in reality is, if I'm a bad person and I'm bigger than you, and I cause all kinds of mayhem in the facility, and they take my tablet away or my commissary rights away, I'm simply going to take your tablet and use your tablet as if it were my tablet.
That's true.
Or I'm going to have my family on the outside put money in your commissary account, and then you're going to go down and buy me whatever it is that I would otherwise have bought. You know,
that is true.
In the world of business, you know, there are competitive non-compete clauses.
Right.
You know,
right.
And what happens is I have a restaurant, I sell the restaurant, and I agree not to open a restaurant within 2 to 3 years or within a certain amount of miles. But that's okay, because I have a son. And my son immediately takes the big pile of cash that I got for selling my business, and he starts a restaurant, and I run it, but I'm not running it. So
right.
Again, so on the in an ideal world, inside a facility, you still have clawbacks. You really don't. There's no taking away the circumstance of putting someone into a solitary confinement setting when they're bad actors. Now, let's also look at what has happened over the last decade in the closing of facilities. We now have maximum security inmates who have been reclassified as medium security inmates and placed in medium security dormitories. So if you're in maximum security prison, you are in a cell by yourself or with one other inmate, and you are locked in, which is safer for you and safer for the other inmates and safer for the guards. If you are in a medium security prison, you are in essentially a pod. It's like a barracks setting where you have individual bedrooms, but you have a common area with your showers, your bathrooms, and your eating and lounging areas. And I don't believe that if there are doors or cell doors on those particular bedroom configurations, they are not lockable. So they either don't have doors or the doors don't lock. So what has been happening, according to the officers I've spoken to, you have a maximum security prisoner being reclassified and going into a medium security facility. And the first thing that person does is let everybody else in that pod know, and we're talking about 60 to 70 souls in this pod, that they are a maximum security person, that they are a really bad actor. And what is happening is these individuals are assaulting other inmates, particularly at night while they're sleeping, sexually. And when those inmates complain, those inmates are then transferred to a different unit, which allows the really bad maximum security offender to have a new bumper crop of fresh people to continue to assault. This is happening on a regular basis. And you have a single officer or two officers sitting at a desk handling 60 to 70 incarcerated individuals. And some of them at this point really don't belong in a medium security setting. And when you're locked in those facilities as an officer, while the inmates have their phone, their tablet, whatever it is, and they can talk to the outside world, the officers may not have their phones in the facilities. And they are locked in so that if they're overpowered, they have to wait for the cavalry to unlock the door and go inside to extract them. Now, truth be told, I would never work in a correctional facility because I simply couldn't do that. But that is the protocol that is being followed. And now let's talk about this job action. There are 13,000 corrections officers, give or take, in the state of New York. Their needs have not been met by the state and by their union, NYSCOPA. And they are very unhappy with their union leadership. And at some point, I think that union leadership will no longer be their union leadership. And they will either elect a new board or they will go with a different bargaining unit. But that being said, since 10,000 of these officers are not going into work right now, our governor activated the National Guard. So now you have 18-year-old kids who join the National Guard for college tuition, to get some military training, to get some discipline, being placed in these facilities and locked in with hardened criminals and being assaulted as well. A nice thing that the inmates like to do is when it's mealtime and the officer opens the tray door in the door, they apparently make Vaseline fireballs. They set toilet paper and Vaseline on fire. And when the door is opened and the nice little National Guardsman is handing them their tray of food, they're being assaulted with a wallet of Vaseline-covered tissue that's on fire that attaches to their clothing and sets their clothing on fire. Or they're being assaulted with instruments. Or in the case of Fishkill, last weekend, an 18-year-old female National Guard officer flipped out. She got locked inside the facility and she started having anxiety. And she flipped out on a corrections staffer, and then she flipped out on like her sergeant in the National Guard, and they carried her out of there in handcuffs and they put her on a psych hold. Okay, my son is 18. I would never expect that if he decides to put on some camouflage and join the National Guard, that he'd wind up in a situation where he could very easily be assaulted or killed. Mm-hmm. Because we're going to have untrained, unqualified young people manning these facilities because somebody's got to man them.
Okay. Should prison guard be one of those occupations where you're just not allowed to go on strike? Because there is no duplicate for you.
So they are not allowed to go on strike. That is the law of the state of New York. The last strike by prison guards was in 1979, which resulted in the Taylor Law. which prohibits specifically corrections officers from striking.
Are they striking now?
They are having a job action where 10,000 of them are not going into their facilities.
Should they not be allowed to have a job action?
That is one of the tools that Kathy Hochul could use, and she is looking to enforce the Taylor Law, which means that they're losing 2 days' pay for every day they're out of work.
Right.
There's only one problem with the Taylor Law. What do you do when 90% of your corrections officers statewide are not reporting to work? That's the problem she has. If it was a smaller group, she could fire them all. They are subject to being fired right now.
She could pull a Reagan.
However, if you fire 10,000 corrections officers and you've only got 3,000 left, you're going to have the National Guard in those prisons and the state police and local police in there for the next 2 years until you hire, train, and certify 10,000 additional officers. And you can't find them. Again,
I was about to say, I
wouldn't take the job, would you?
No, when I was inside, the guards kind of knew I didn't belong there, and like they wouldn't even let me take a job because they're like, you're not going to be here long enough. Everybody kind of knew it was wrong, so they talked to me differently than they spoke with other inmates.
Correct.
So I'm talking to one guard. And he's like, I'm going to retire in 3 weeks. I'm like, that's fantastic. And he's like, it's not. I'm like 50-something, and, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. But I talked to my wife, and I've been in a prison longer now than if I had killed somebody. And
it's terrible.
Yeah.
I really don't.
No, so you know, I think we also have to factor into this conversation just the wear and tear, man. You are like, imagine you go to work and like I go to work and I make a show and the people that listen to it want to listen to it. You're a prison guard. You go to work. There's nobody who wants you there. You don't want to be there. The people you are assigned to protect and also discipline don't want to be there. Nobody wants to be there. You get the prison experience without you get to go have lunch in a different room than everybody else. But the majority of your day, you're getting the prison experience. And you're 100% right. Where I was, there's one guard at kind of a desk at the top of the block, and there's 60 or 70. And it weren't all John Burtons. There's 60 or 70 people in a U shape around you who if anybody makes a bad decision, it's a minute before anybody gets to you.
Right.
So you're constantly outnumbered, you're constantly under threat, you're constantly getting the prison experience the same as the inmates. You're not getting any sunlight, you're in cinder block, you're listening to the same foul language all the time. And you're the target if something goes wrong. It's an impossible job.
It is. And they're not, I mean, frankly, they're not paid enough no matter how much they give them. You're absolutely correct. I went to a police academy, and the guy who stood in front of me had been a New York State corrections officer before he got to this police academy. And unfortunately for him, like within a day, I knew he was not going to make it because he had already become too institutionalized.
Right.
He could not make the transition from corrections to police officer because he had been a corrections officer for too long. He was too regimented. You know, when you're a police officer, you have to take initiative. You have to think on your feet. You have to pivot.
Yeah.
Much more so than in an institutionalized setting. And there's good reasons for that. There are good reasons in corrections why you have a formulaic response to certain things. But those characteristics in a correction setting might not necessarily work in a law enforcement setting as a police officer. So, no, I mean, it's a very difficult job. But
is this the only legitimate argument I could make for privatized for profitized prisons?
So, I actually dealt with them too. I dealt with an organization called the GEO Group, G-E-O. They did privatized corrections in other states, and they did immigration corrections for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE as it is now. That's a blessing and a curse, too. There are benefits to privatized corrections, and there are deficits. And I don't think you'll ever see that happening in New York. What we need to do is get the corrections officers who are not working back to work, but give them the tools they need. And it's like this thing with the air traffic controllers we're seeing right now. The salaries are not suitable to attract and retain. So instead of putting more people on the street, okay, the state of New York since the late 70s, early 80s has deinstitutionalized millions of people. And some people say that's a great thing. Well, we closed the mental hospitals first, and all of those people hit the streets, and a lot of them wound up in our major cities, where they then got arrested and went from being in the mental health institution to the correctional institution. And then we've realized we have so many mentally ill people in our jails that we need to treat them, which they clearly need, but we created the monster that put them in jails in the first place.
That is 150% correct. As a mentally ill person who was in jail, that is 150% correct.
So now we have a situation where to save money, we want to close facilities, not have as many staff, and give these people correctional alternatives to corrections, therapies. Okay, when I was in law school, I had to sit through a domestic violence offender program. And I went in there in, you know, as a fellow offender, okay? They didn't tell them I'm actually in law school and I'm going to be a prosecutor. They just had me sit there, and before the program started, they'd all be talking. It's like an AA meeting for, you know, domestic abusers. And no one in that room had any interest in helping themselves not be a bad person. I mean, they were all going to do the exact same behavior as soon as they got done with this program that got them there in the first place. But when the meeting started, they could talk a good game. So, you know, sometimes therapy works, sometimes, you know, mediation works, but sometimes it doesn't. And there are people out there who belong in an institutionalized correctional setting. And we need to get behind this. You know, the reason I wanted to do this podcast is to make the public aware of just how much these guys are up against. Okay.
It's an impossible job. And now
try doing it for 24 hours and coming back 8 hours later and doing 16 hours. And people on the street are like, oh my God, they're making so much overtime. You can't spend the overtime. You're working so many hours.
Right.
And the overtime, it's like blood money. Okay.
Yeah. There's another factor to what lines up with what you're saying. So I spent in total, and again, my time wasn't stereotypical time because again, everybody kind of knew it was just messed up and I was going to get out and be okay. But I did spend 2.5 months aggregate in a jail. there was, during my 2.5 months, no rehabilitative minute. Not a minute of rehabilitation. And now, imagine you work in a state prison with that same level. You don't get better on your own. So now you're working with a population that every day the steam is a little higher, and the steam is a little higher, and the steam is a little higher because they're not getting rehabilitated. They're not, most of these programs are self-initiated. Rehabilitation doesn't work that way. You need to be pushed. And so now you're working with a population that, you know, isn't getting any better every day that they're in there. So my Thursday is going to be worse than my Tuesday, and my next Thursday is going to be worse than that because nothing's happening to help. So you don't even get the satisfaction, really, of sitting down and saying, okay, this is a horrible job, I'm under a lot of pressure, but when Burton gets out, I know I'm part of a system that when Burton gets out, he's got a fresh start and he can change things around because he learned something in here. You know that's not even the case.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, you bring up a good point. And I think that holds true for the officers. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
When you're under this kind of pressure and you're working this many hours, you're simply unable to cope. And I can tell you from personal experience. So there's another piece of this that the public is not aware of. There is a ton of contraband in the jails, tons of drugs. Okay. They are not screening the packages properly. It's almost willful at this point. And I can't speak to why, but this administration is allowing narcotics to enter these facilities, and these inmates are using them, and they are endangering themselves, and they're endangering other inmates, and they're endangering officers. We have situations where officers are being overcome by fentanyl, other inmates are being overcome by fentanyl. Okay, in my other work, I have been inside several facilities for people who passed away unattended. If you're an inmate of New York State, you are under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner in the county wherein you die, and a full autopsy is usually performed. I've gone to prisons and transported people back who were dead from overdoses. Mm. And you say to yourself, how do they get the drugs when they're in this jail? That is one issue. The other issue with the corrections side is the officers themselves are also, succumbing to the pressures of this job. I've had the misfortune of having to deal with a corrections officer who committed suicide. He ended his shift and killed himself inside the facility where he got changed into his civilian clothing because they're working so many hours. And if they themselves are suffering from mental health issues or depression issues, and I mean, for crying out loud, if you're working in those facilities, it's extremely depressing.
Yeah.
They're at a higher risk of self-harm than your average person.
Sure. Yeah.
So, these are real issues. I don't know what the numbers are on correction officer suicides in the state over the past 2 years, but I would assume the number is pretty alarming.
It would almost have to be, because you can't spend, I don't understand how you do 24 hours, but even an 8-hour shift in that facility is going to ding your mental health, and aggregate that over time and spend as much time in prison as somebody who killed somebody. Of course, you're going to get banged up. Where are you on no prison time for victimless crime, possession, stuff like that, to get the population down to where it's manageable?
Victimless is an amorphous word.
Right.
I can't speak to where I would be on that in this setting right now today. I mean,
okay.
This is a fast and dirty to get the message out about the kind of pressure that these officers are under. As soon as you can get this published, I'll try to get it up tonight. That'd be great. And send me the links.
You got it.
But I think alternatives to incarceration is a very good idea. Okay. I think, but there has to be a balance. Okay. So in New York City, Alvin Bragg and other DAs have said, unless you steal more than $500 worth of merchandise from a store at one time, we're not going to even, you can get charged by the police, but we're going to dismiss the charge of petty larceny.
Right.
So that tells people, well, geez, I guess it's okay if I take $499 worth of stuff every single day.
Right.
And
which is crazy.
Again, this does create a situation where otherwise law-abiding people will become, for lack of a better word, criminals.
I completely agree with you. I would do it too. If I'm making $399 a week, and my other choice is go steal, essentially make $500 a day. I'm good, and I got a kid. I'm gonna do it. Like, I get that. And that's the system's fault.
Let's not even go that deep into it. Let's say, you got a family to provide for. And since there's really no consequence for a little bit of petty larceny.
Yeah.
When I go through the self-checkout, perhaps if I bought 2 gallons of milk, that third gallon I forgot to scan.
Right.
I bought Cheerios and ground beef. Well, maybe I scan the ground beef, but I forget about the Cheerios. You're kind of encouraging law-abiding people to become offenders.
Totally.
Usually, under the law of the state of New York, it is fairly black and white. Okay, there's no such thing as playing just the tip when it comes to criminal behavior.
Right.
And when you see what is happening on the streets, when you see people being given a free pass for bad behavior, when you see violence being met with no bail being set, people just, you have a dispute with your neighbor. Your neighbor breaks every window in your car. And they're crazy. At least they'd go to jail, maybe, prior to the bail reform. Now, they're sitting right back on the stoop watching you with a grin on their face because they got issued a ticket and the judge said, please don't do that again.
We've done this before, but the problem is your wife is pissed off at you, your neighbor's car gets all the windows broken in, and your wife goes to a cop and says, you did it, and if you can't afford to get out, you're in for something you didn't do. And or Patrick, who's a wealthy real estate mogul, and John Burton, who's a lowly podcast host, get arrested for the same crime, and the bail is $100, and Pat can afford it, and John can't. And we're both innocent until we're both innocent. Different show. Make your closing argument so that I can get this up tonight, if I can.
So, if anybody is watching this, it is my hope that the state can come to fair and equitable terms with the corrections officers to get them back on the job. That includes halting the HALT Act. And not just halting it for 90 days. The latest thing is they're going to cease it for 90 days. This was bad law. With the path to hell is paved with good intentions. Legislators put forth this law, and it passed, and it is bad law, and it needs to be revoked. And the governor has the power to do that, and we need to get these officers the tools they need to do their job properly, and we need to pay them more. Okay,
yeah.
Right now, young kids are coming out of the corrections academy, going inside, seeing how insane it is.
Why would I do that?
And quitting.
Yeah.
Or going to a county jail. Now they're trained by the state. The state has invested in them, and they are leaving because the job is not as described. This is a very dangerous situation, and it has been created by our state leadership.
Yep.
And it has to stop. So remember, November 26th, I'll be there to help you.
Beautiful, Pat. Thank you, as always,
thank
man.
Thank you very much.
No, my pleasure, man. I'll write you when this is up.
Thank you so much.
All right, brother. Thanks.
Have a great day. Take care.
You too. Bye.